Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi.
Siri. Welcome to High Theory.
In this podcast, we get high on the substance of theory. I'm Kim Adams.
And I'm Sharunik Boshu.
We are two tired academics trying to save critique from itself.
Hello, and welcome to today's episode, which is titled Abolition. And we have with us today Sean Gordon. Sean, would you mind introducing yourself?
I'm Sean Gordon. I just recently defended my dissertation.
Congratulations.
Yeah, thank you very much. In English and American Studies at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. I teach and write primarily about 19th century American literature, abolition, and the environmental humanities. I love the podcast. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you so much for coming. I will jump right ahead and ask you my first question. What the heck is abolition?
Well, as I'm sure you can imagine, abolition is many different things to many different people.
Yeah.
But I basically think about it in two ways. One is it's the historical movement to end the transatlantic slave trade and the system of racialized slavery it birthed. And on this point, while abolition per se starts off in the 17th century as a kind of liberal reform movement among capitalist class interests, with really like no particular investment in abolishing the kind of racial social dynamics on which it depended.
Yeah.
It transforms into a much more radical program in the 19th centuries, oriented toward the immediate end of slavery and the reconstruction of social relationships. This transformation can be kind of traced between, say, like Alauda Equiano in the 1780s and 90s and David Walker and William Lloyd Garrison in the 1820s and 30s. Another way to define abolition is as a more transhistorical movement that's come to exceed the particular demand to end slavery. And it now involves and is used much more so in the context of prison abolition and transformative justice. This is the version of abolition that W.E.B. Du Bois referred to in the 1930s as abolition democracy in his book Black Reconstruction. And that Angela Davis and Ruth Wilson Gilmore have also taken up in relation to the prison industrial complex, empire, torture, and that the writer, organizer, and educator Mariam Kaba defines as, quote, a political vision, a structural analysis of oppression, and a practical organizing strategy. That involves things that we've seen a lot of lately, I would say, defunding the police,
right,
ending all aspects of the prison industrial complex, and mutual aid. And then I would say a third way to define abolition is in terms of those who understand it very fearfully as a program of complete disorder, akin to anarchy, right?
Right. Yeah.
And I guess I'm referring to a lot of the fear-mongering politicians and news media figures who I would say abuse the term, but in a sense they're not wrong about its commitment to disorder and racial capitalism, as well as the modes of being under racial capitalism. That phrase, program of complete disorder, comes from Fanon's discussion of what constitutes decolonization. But it's an important lens for a number of scholars in Black studies, such as Frank Wilderson and Jared Sexton, to think through the end of the world that has slavery. So I always keep in mind this somewhat pithy phrase from one of Jared Sexton's essays, where he writes of abolition that slavery is the threshold of the political world, abolition the interminable radicalization of every radical movement.
Right.
This just one short phrase gets at what Kaba calls a structural analysis of oppression, namely that, you know, just recognizing that we enter the political sphere through slavery. And at the same time, it speaks to what abolitionists are here on this earth to do, which is to get to the root of politics to uproot civil society. So you can understand why the guardians of civil society are pretty scared about that, but it's weird too because of this extent to which so many abolitionists do their work out of love.
You know, you mentioned the word uproot, and also times we kind of stray from that particular association when we say the word radical, and radical literally has to do with roots.
Exactly.
And so on that note, I was wondering, we'll get an opportunity to talk about abolition as we understand it in our present moment, but I'm really interested in, as an answer to the first question that I asked, like, could you give us a sense of the origin of the term, if, I mean, even etymology, I guess, to a certain extent?
Radical is the root word of radical is root. So there is a kind of like way in which uprooting the institutions of civil society is an important part of that radicalization. And I take that sort of literally, but I think, you know, maybe we'll have time to talk about what that means in, as a kind of like environmental disposition as well, or as a kind of attitude toward territory and land. That's kind of interesting. But abolition, my, you know, best understanding or sort of briefest summary of the etymology of abolition is that it comes from Latin as well, like abolere, which does mean destruction. But I think it's, you know, it's so important to recognize the relationship between destruction and reconstruction in this context, that the abolition has this, you know, it's a full sounding word that kind of has this apocalyptic sort of sense to it, but it's also really open, and I think has always had this element of what I've come to think of as presencing. That's sort of from Ruth Wilson Gilmore, like abolition is about presence. I think that's always been a sort of part of the abolitionist project. It does come from destruction, but it's bent on reconstruction and presencing and flourishing, I think.
How do we use abolition?
There's a way to use abolition as a structural analysis, as I just said, as a lens for understanding the world.
Yeah.
And there are ways to use it as a guidepost for organizing. As a guidepost for organizing, I think using abolition can be pretty straightforward and even kind of schematic. If we are abolitionists or want to be, we can really ask ourselves some pretty simple questions, like, why are so many resources given to the military, the prison system, and the police, while far fewer resources are given to healthcare, shelter, education, etc.? And that begins to get at the structural analysis part. And we should continue to ask those questions, right? But if we are committed to it, to abolition, we can also do a lot more. We can, for instance, oppose any mode of police reform that strengthens policing, and we can take steps to decrease police power. There was quite a lot of success with such measures all throughout last summer, when police budgets were really being cut and resources reallocated to education, healthcare, mutual aid. We can also use abolition in the transformative justice sense of imagining alternatives to prison, policing, and punishment, and putting transformative justice practices into our communities by understanding how and why harm is caused, supporting survivors of harm, and building structures of acknowledgement and accountability. Right. And again, the question we learn from organizers like Kaba isn't about whether or not to call the police in an emergency, but why are the police the only people to call? And if you really want to take abolition to heart, or abolition is the radicalization of every radical movement, then it really starts to become this sort of more nebulous way of life or way of being than simply an interpretive lens or an object to interpret. I think there are basically a few ways to do it, but it's something I'm really just genuinely interested in discussing. So like one way would be to just think about how to radicalize our writing, consider our citational practices, or, you know, consider the assumptions we have about intellectual property and all that. But then there's also whether abolition could be a literary theory or a theory of narrative. We could say it would require noticing how integral policing and, you know, focalizing police characters are in American television and cinema.
Oh, yeah.
But on a more narratological level, it would require thinking about the status of narrative closure and resolution in cinema, in the novel form. But I tend to think poetry and music, because of their potential for like grammatical disorder and synesthesia,
right,
are sort of where abolition is at. And but it, you know, it's just something to consider, like what are abolitionist narratives, abolitionist yeah. grammars, is abolition representable? And it's something to look for and something to work toward.
How will abolition save the world?
There's no doubt that abolition will save the world, but yeah. it's a complicated question, to the extent that abolition can also be seen as a way to end the world. And I listened to your colleague do the Afro-pessimism episode, and I think...
Diane, yeah.
Yeah, I think Diane had a similar sort of response to the question. But, you know, because abolition can be seen as a way to end the world, or more importantly, to reconstruct or remake the world, to build a new world, like yeah. an end to this world. You know, part of me thinks that it will save the world and has already done so through a commitment to mutual aid, you know, communicability across difference, accountability.
Yeah.
When I say it's already done so, I'm saying I think that the world would already be over if not for abolitionists, in a
yeah.
sense.
Yeah.
Abolitionists have always been saving the world or preserving some sacred aspect of it that otherwise would have been destroyed. And, you know, this is where I was kind of going to talk a little bit about the etymology of the term, too, because it does mean destruction. And yet scholars have been pointing toward abolition as a presencing project, as a flourishing yeah. project. You know, in a scholarly sense, there's a lot being written about sort of the tensions between Black studies and Native studies. And a book that I didn't get a chance to read in full in preparation for the podcast, but a book that is, it seems to be trying to some sort of like resolve some of those tensions or work at the intersection of Black studies and Native studies is Tiffany Lethabo King's The Black Shoals,
yeah.
whose subtitle is Offshore Formations of Black and Native Studies. We have to be thinking abolition in relation to decolonization and indigenous revitalization, and that we should be thinking of abolition in the same terms that we think about police reforms, which is to say that is abolition increasing the capacity for settler colonialism, or is it working in tandem with decolonization? Because I think that the abolition movement, historically speaking, in the 19th century, sort of does, in a sense, increase the capacity for the state, does increase the capacity of the state. And that's a problem I, you know, need to study a little bit more. But I also acknowledge my particular position as a settler here and just want to note that the settler's relationship to abolition should not justify an increased capacity to be here. Abolition calls for a much more radical program of existential disorder, I think, that is only becoming, only really starting to become apparent to me as a thinker, as a writer. I know some other people who write about it, but it's a really kind of difficult set of questions to answer, you know, what is dancing with death, like Frank Wilderson says, what does existential disorder look like? What is an abolition look like that doesn't increase the capacity of the state, but works in tandem with decolonization
right.
and land back movements and, you know, indigenous revitalization.
We decided to do abolition. One of the reasons for that was its centrality in your work.
Yeah.
And so, you know, on an ending note, could you give us a sense of what you're working with right now, how abolition is, you know, crucial to that?
I write about, or in my dissertation anyway, I wrote about some figures like Henry David Thoreau and, you know, some New England abolitionists and stuff. Partly that was just personal, so like some stuff I'm trying to work through in a place where I'm from. But
right.
what I found is that it just seemed to me that abolition had it was a much broader aesthetic project and an environmental project. So just to take Thoreau as an example, he's known for this essay about civil disobedience that has been used by figures like Martin Luther King Jr. and Gandhi to sort of talk about civil disobedience and nonviolence. But when John Brown basically tried to take over a federal armory and disperse the ammunition and the weapons that were there to instigate a massive slave insurrection, Thoreau was one of the first ones to defend him in public and write about the effort in terms of the requirement for violence to meet state violence, you know, the requirement to meet violence with violence in a certain way. But also, he wrote about it in a way that was really linked up with some of his environmental thinking. And I don't think that he really saw John Brown's, you know, attack on Harper's Ferry or his intentions there as a form of destruction. I think he saw it as a form of dispersion, right, that it was to, you know, basically to disperse life. And he was at the same time writing about seed dispersion and how like trees and fruits propagate. And it's, you know, I'm don't want to get too like in the weeds, if you will, right, about, yeah, Thoreau, but it was just kind of a pathway to seeing abolition as related to kind of like presencing in an environmental sense, and also just the sort of like life-giving aspect of abolition, though it's all, you know, often misrepresented as a entirely a program of destruction or, right, wanton, you know, irresponsible destruction. Well, I think that, you know, Thoreau and John Brown, these figures that I've written a little bit about, had no sort of like fealty to the preservation of the slaveholding state.
Thank you so much, Sean, for coming, yeah, to our, sure, podcast, yeah, talking to us about abolition.
Yeah, it was a pleasure to be here. It's great to talk with you. And yeah, I'm glad I got to speak to this really important topic.
And thank you for listening to High Theory.
If you like our podcast, please review and subscribe on Spotify, iTunes, Patreon, or wherever you get your podcast fix.
Sharonic Bosu manages our social media presence. Owen Quinn composes our theme music, and Kim Adams and Sharonic Bosu edit our audio.
You can also find us at hightheory.net.
We hope you have a highly theoretical day.